Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 214, I chat with Pioneer's chief speaker designer, Andrew Jones, about the company's new Atmos-enabled speakers and AV receivers. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 10th, 2014. Episode 214, Dolby Atmos Comes Home. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Andrew Jones, director of loudspeaker engineering at Pioneer Electronics, also at TAD Labs, an offshoot, I guess, of Pioneer. But we're here to talk about Pioneer today. Hey, Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. I always love coming on the show and talking.
Well, I always look forward to having you here because you always have great things to say, and you are certainly one of the preeminent speaker designers in the world. And so I listen very closely to everything you say.
See, that's why I like coming on the show.
There you go. See?
Who could resist comments like that?
Exactly. Who could? Hey, those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Andrew, and I will pass along as many as I can. Now, of course, the reason that you're here today is because of the big news that we heard at CE Week, kind of a micro CES in New York City a couple weeks ago, when it was announced that Dolby Atmos was finally coming home. This was such big news, I thought. And lo and behold, Pioneer's booth was awash in products that actually had Dolby Atmos capabilities. So you and I spent a nice long time talking about them there, and I wanted to make sure that the chat room or the podcast audience got to hear much about it. So what can you tell me about how Dolby Atmos came to be now available in the home?
Well, we started hearing about it, certainly more than a year ago, maybe 18 months. Dolby were giving private demonstrations to partners that they thought would be needed to bring this technology into the home. And that obviously includes receiver manufacturers and speaker manufacturers. And so they showed it to some representatives from Pioneer, but not me.
What? Why not?
They were either too nervous that maybe I might criticize it, or maybe I might guess how they're doing it. So I was kept out, but I heard the reports that, oh, this is something different. It's something interesting. And so maybe 6 months later, they'd got it more ready to show to more people, and I was invited along to listen at a private event at Cedia, I think. And it was described as a new surround sound format that adds height information. And I'm going, oh, yeah, like we need yet more channels. And I shouldn't really say that, like we need more speakers. But you know what I mean.
Of course, well, we sure. I mean, for you, any more speakers that people want to buy is fine, I'm sure. But we've already had height channels in Dolby ProLogic 2Z and in Odyssey DSX and DTS. Neo X as well, but their height in front of you. What Dolby Atmos is talking about really is true height, that is speakers on the ceiling.
Initially, yes, and certainly in the movie theater, speakers on the ceiling. And so that idea is now being made ready for the home. But it goes beyond just the idea of, oh, stick some more speakers around. It's a whole change in the way that the sound is mapped. And by that I mean in the past that when you mix the sound, you mix them for the particular channels that it might come through. And so translating the experience from the theatre into the home could be kind of hit and miss. What they've done now is what they're calling an object-oriented approach. And that is, just like with any music, like an MP3 file, it has metadata with it that tells you what the track is and the musicians and whatever. When they mix the movie soundtracks, each sound, individual sound that they put in the mix, has got metadata now attached to it, which defines where within 3D space that sound is supposed to be located. So when you come to decode it, the decoder recognizes whatever setup you've got, and then it will try and place that object by playing the sound back through the appropriate mix of channels. Just like pan-potting between stereo, it's pan-potting in any 3D direction around and above you, and will now work out how to mix the sound back out through all the channels that you have to get it as close as possible to where the sound's got to come from.
So give us an idea of how Dolby Atmos works, what the concept is. I know that it goes beyond what we consider channel-based audio, you know, 5.1 channels, 7.1 channels. Dolby Atmos really does go beyond that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It can map to any number of channels in the decoding process. And because of the object-oriented approach, meaning each sound is tagged with information as to where it's supposed to come from, then in the decoding process, it will then recognize the number of channels, where the speakers are located, and kind of pan-pot that image to be located where it was tagged to supposed to come from.
Mm-hmm. So for example, a helicopter flying over from front left to rear right or something like that, that sound is tagged with some metadata that tells the system where it's supposed to be, and the system then plays it on whatever speaker it thinks it needs to in order to make that effect.
Yeah, and not just whichever speaker, but whichever speaker combination that you apply the appropriate amplitude and phasing information to fool the ear into believing that the sound is in that particular location.
Got it.
So when I heard it, yeah, I went in, I have to say, a bit skeptical, but they played it. They had a setup where they mounted some speakers overhead. And, you know, at that stage, I hadn't actually listened to it in a movie theater. So this is the first time I was hearing the Atmos system. And they played it, and I thought, whoa, this actually works. But now we've got extra channels, and not only do we have, let's say, a 5.1 system, but now we've got speakers in the ceiling. What percentage of people are actually going to do the combination? You know, if it's one or the other. Now it's both.
Right. I've always said that the speakers on the ceiling have a very low spousal acceptance factor. So very few people are actually going to install speakers in their ceiling.
Unless you're an interior designer. And they won't even let you have the walls these days. And they, well, I suppose we could put them on the ceiling. And there's already lights there. Now this is both. But they then understood my objections and said, okay, we know that a lot of people won't do this. We have a system that can sort of virtualize the overhead information. And they proceeded to show us prototypes of the 5.1 speakers, where the front left, front right, rear left, and rear right have each an additional upward-firing drive unit, a drive unit with a certain response characteristic, a certain angle. And the idea is this will, because it's pointing up towards the ceiling, the sound will be reflected off the ceiling. And what you're mostly aware of is the image of that speaker coming from an equidistance above the ceiling as it is in reality below. So you're fooled into thinking you've now got four speakers way above you towards the front and to the rear, which are providing the extra information. And I listened to the same demos over both the real speakers and these reflected image speakers. And I said, I actually prefer the reflected version.
Really? Why is that?
I think because you're relying on auditory clues or cues to understand in the vertical direction where sound is coming from. You know, you've got the pinna around the ears. The effective response you hear from a sound source is modified by height. You get peaks and dips in the response from reflections around the ear, and that gives you the clue for height. So if you're trying to virtualize it up above and you've got ceiling speakers too close to you, I think you hear both the real location of the speaker and the supposed location of where the sound is coming from. Now, this is conjecture on my part. You know, I can't quote the research.
you can't back this up with mathematics and diagrams.
But however, what I felt was just a more homogeneous sound field using the reflected process. And for me, that was a no-brainer, because rather than having both the 5.1 speakers and the ceiling speakers and having to wire it all up, now you've got a speaker, wherever you've got a speaker already, it's just an upward firing addition to that. You run an extra cable to each of those four speakers, and now you've got a system that works. And as I got more involved in understanding the psychoacoustics of how they'd made this work, I began to think, I can even maybe believe the science behind it. I certainly believed the auditory effect, and I was actually quite excited about it. So rather than just thinking we were going to do the processor, you know, the receiver as our contribution to being one of the Atmos partners, we thought, you know what, we should do some speakers. And so that's how my part of the project started.
M5 in the chat room is asking, for those of us who for whom it is possible to put speakers on the ceiling, very accepting spouse or whatever, is there an option for us? As can the receiver actually feed real speakers on the ceiling?
Yes, it can. So if we think of, let's say, what they call a 5.1.4 system, that would be five speakers plus your subwoofer plus four speakers for height information. So you've got this nine-channel receiver, but just with different decoding within the processor. It will now feed the speakers that are built on top of the fronts and the rear speakers are an entirely independent speaker. They're not internally wired to the main input terminals and some processing going on inside the speaker. They're an entirely separate speaker and wired separately directly to the other channels on the receiver. So whether you've got the speakers placed upwards in the front and rear speakers, or you've got ceiling speakers, it's the same process. Wire them to the back of the receiver independently. Then in the setup procedure, in the graphical interface, you will be able to choose and to say, do I have ceiling speakers or do I have what are called Atmos-enabled speakers? The enabled part meaning the upward firing driver in the main speakers. That way the receiver knows what to expect and then can calibrate everything accordingly. And it's actually, we went through this process just last week to try it out with our new receiver. And it's a very straightforward process to do.
Now, I know that receivers aren't your thing, but just so that we get a complete picture of the system here, in addition to these Atmos-enabled speakers with the upward firing drivers or perhaps real speakers on the ceiling, you need an AVR, an AV receiver, or a preamp processor that can decode a Dolby Atmos bitstream, right?
Yes, you do. And it requires a whole different class of DSP processing to do all of this. So older receivers will not be able to be updated to decode Atmos. If you've got an Atmos encoded film soundtrack, it'll still play back over 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever you've got. It just won't make use of the information to decode the height channels.
Many people have already asked me, well, can I get a firmware update to my existing AV receiver? And the answer, as I have already understood it and you have just verified, is no. It's a whole new piece of hardware that you need.
In nearly every instance, yes. I can't say for absolutely every manufacturer as to whether they already had some, but pretty much every receiver out there has got to be a new receiver with the new hardware. And some of those receivers were in process of being manufactured and not yet fitted with the upgraded firmware. And they will be marketed out or sold as Atmos upgradable, let's say.
Got it.
And so you can buy them now, even though all of the final verification for the firmware has not been fully finished. You know, it's about to be. It's imminent. We're all working on this previously.
I know that Onkyo announced a couple of receivers that would be updated by a firmware update. So there's an example of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, we've got selling seasons, and we have to get it into the stores anyway. But by making upgradable, you know, in our instance, plug in a thumb drive onto the front of the receiver, and it'll upgrade itself.
Mm. But the good news is that you don't need a new Blu-ray player, do you?
No, you don't. Pretty much every Blu-ray player will just pass through the information over HDMI and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. I say pretty much because I don't say every, or else someone will go, but it doesn't work with mine.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much it's intended to work with standard Blu-ray players. So you do not, in most instances, need to change your Blu-ray player.
But you will need to buy Atmos encoded Blu-rays in order to get that extra information, which have not been available and still aren't available quite yet, right?
That's right. We've had our test discs and demo discs provided by Dolby. They will be announcing availability. What with the timescales that we've been all working to, the hardware manufacturers, ourselves and Onkyo and Denon and all these others and all the speaker manufacturers, we've been able to announce, yes, we've got the equipment, it's scheduled for release imminently, and then Dolby will be announcing for themselves availability of the software, and that they'll have that press release available within the next month or so, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm expecting probably availability of some of the first titles, maybe, you know, in the early fall or something like that. Of course, it means if you already have a Blu-ray of a particular movie and now it's coming back out in Atmos, you're going to have to buy it again.
As always.
As always. 'Twas ever thus.
That's right.
It's like I remember when every time a new audio format comes out, it's like, oh, man, I got to buy the White Album again.
Yes, I mean, that's the unfortunate fact. There's no way of getting around that, of course. And then you have to decide for yourself, as this equipment becomes available and you get a chance to listen to a demo, you decide for yourself the value of it. I decided I liked it enough to say, yeah, let's go ahead and develop some speakers. I read all the forums. There's a lot of negativity towards it right now. You know, oh, another format. Oh, how can this possibly work? Oh, I don't need this. And I'm just saying, you know, I kind of had that thought going in, and I don't now. So I think just get the demonstration and see what you think then.
Keep an open mind.
Keep an open mind. Before multi-channel, we had only stereo. Then we got kind of four channels. Then we got five. Then we got seven. Then we got nine. And it keeps on changing and evolving. This is just a new evolution. I think sound-wise, it's a big step up from just having lateral sound spread.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I heard the demos at CE Week. That was the first time I'd heard the home demos. I had gone to many Atmos presentations in the commercial cinema, and I really loved the sound in the commercial cinema. I think it's fabulous. And so hearing it at home and hearing these demos, the Pioneer demo in particular, with an Epson projector and Screen Innovation screen. Boy, the scene from Life of Pi where the ship is sinking and the rain is coming down on top of you is very effective. I just love it. And so I'm really happy to see this coming home.
Yes, and I think it's not going to have to rely on helicopters flying over to justify it.
Yes, I agree.
It's the ambience of being more, feeling you're more in that sound field that really makes a big difference. You know, scenes where you're in a forest and you've got birds flying over, or just the sounds all around you. Yes. It's good.
Yeah. This was particularly effective, I thought, in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which opens publicly tomorrow. I got to see a preview screening, and that I saw that in Dolby Atmos. And the sound of just the monkeys all over you in the trees all around and stuff was fabulous. Just very effective.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's definitely what attracted me, just that feeling of being more immersed into it.
Mm, exactly. Web8018 in the chat room is asking, can the bookshelf speakers, we're going to talk about the specific models in a minute, but we know that you have some bookshelf speakers and some floor standing models. And his question is, can the bookshelf speakers be wall mounted or can the floor standers be placed against a wall? I guess my first question would be, that wouldn't be so easy if they're vented in the rear. If they have a port in the rear, that would make it kind of difficult to do. But why don't you answer that question?
I'm thinking that's a much more practical. When you pick up these speakers, you'll realize why you just don't want to risk wall mounting these. These are not small bookshelves. They're not as big as my TAD bookshelf, which is, never really was a bookshelf. It's a compact monitor. But yeah, they're very heavy, and I haven't gone for the true entry-level price point with these. I discussed it with Chris Walker, who's works with me on managing the projects, and we decided that because it's new, we wanted to do something that really could show off the full benefits of what Atmos can do. And it gave me an opportunity, therefore, to design a speaker at a higher price point than my entry-level ones. I haven't abandoned the entry-level projects. You know, there'll be more stuff coming along. But I wanted an opportunity to step up significantly and design a really good loudspeaker for this. And as a result, I put lots into it, and it's not a small wall-mounted satellite speaker to go with a subwoofer. It's really a stand-mount speaker rather than truly a bookshelf in that sense, and capable of good bass in its own right. And on music, it sounds wonderful and extended. But as part of a home theatre system, yes, you've got the subwoofer to support the real bottom end.
And what about the floor standers? Can you really put them up against the wall? I normally don't recommend that, just because of the way speakers interact with rooms. You want them out in the room if you can.
Yeah, I think you, especially with the floor stander with its extended bass extension capability, it would be a mistake to cram them right against the wall. It's not just, as you say, it's not just the factor of do you block the vents. You know, if you're maybe, say, 4 inches away from the wall, you're not going to block the vents. And so what you need is to consider how does it integrate into the room. And putting the speakers against the wall is just going to not really load the room very well. Or maybe I should say it will load it too much.
Too much. Exactly. Yeah. We have a picture of a diagram from Pioneer of how the Atmos home system works with these up-firing speakers, which we can show you here. And as you'll see, you've got the front floor standers and the surround speakers. And the four of those speakers have up-firing drivers that are beaming up to the ceiling and then reflecting back down. This relates to a question from Laird in the chat room, who asks that Pioneer is recommending a ceiling height of 8 to 14 feet for Atmos-enabled speakers. I think that's a Dolby spec, if I'm not mistaken. But the question really is, what if the ceiling is less than 8 feet? Will the reflected speakers still work?
Well, yes, certainly this is a a Dolby spec. They've done all the work to determine what the optimum ceiling heights are. Now, that's, of course, optimum ceiling heights. If the ceiling's too high or too... Well, let's say if it's too high, you got to put a lot more energy to get the sound up there and back again. The effective reflected speaker appears too far away, and you won't get the full effect. Will you get some effect? Yes, but you won't get the optimum effect. Mm. If it's too low, I'd maybe... Angles could be a difficulty, but I don't know how much lower that listener is talking about.
Well, he actually specifies 7 feet 6 inches, so it's half an inch. That's not going to be a big deal, is it?
No, no, that's fine. Yeah. It'll still it will work for that. Yes.
Yeah. What about cathedral ceilings or pitched ceilings? I've been asked that several times. I think it wouldn't work as well.
It's not going to work as well, and it depends on which angle or which direction the pitch is going. If the pitch is from the front of the room up towards the middle, then back down towards the rear, that will work. Particularly if you use some of these in-ceiling speakers that already got some built-in angle, then you can just rotate the angle to partially offset the angle of the ceiling, mm-hmm. and it will work. I'm just thinking in my mind right now, if the pitch is going from left to right, you could probably do something similar. So yeah. It's not optimum, but it could work for mounting speakers in the ceiling. But from a reflection point of view, certainly a pitch from front to back, you're not going to get the sound to reflect back into the listening space. Mm-hmm. So it's the bounced version that is not going to work very well with pitched ceilings.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's where you're going to need to have real speakers of some yeah. form.
Yeah. A couple people in the chat room, Synthetic Shrimp, and Jammer B, are asking about the surface of the ceiling. Since Synthetic Shrimp asks, I guess then you wouldn't want to put room treatments, acoustic treatments on the ceiling. You'd want the ceiling to be fairly reflective. And Jammer B, of course, says, I've got a popcorn ceiling. That wouldn't work very well, would it?
Actually, yes, it wants to be pretty much reflective. You're not going to put... absorptive treatments in the position of the first bounce. If you were doing a stereo system and you were going to treat the ceiling just like with the sidewalls, you'd put the absorber at the position of the first bounce. Obviously, that's exactly the opposite of what you want to do with the Atmos.
You don't want that in this case, yes.
But there are other places around the ceiling where you could put absorbent to kill the overall reflection coefficient of the ceiling and kill some of the general ambience in the room, just not directly where the image of that speaker is supposed to reflect. Right. Popcorn ceilings, they're fine. The dispersion throughout most of the frequency range is so small, you know, the specular nature, the diffraction is so small that most of the practical frequencies that it's going to be fine. It would only affect the very, very highest frequencies. So, popcorn, I would say, is fine.
Okay, very good. What about the directional characteristics of those upward-firing speakers? I've been wondering about this, and I got some questions in the chat room earlier about if the sound coming out of that upward-firing speaker spreads out wide and quick, you would get some of it direct before it got to the ceiling and back. So I would think that the upward-firing Atmos speaker element would need to be fairly directional.
Indeed, yes. You're right that some of the sound, let's say it was perfectly omnidirectional at all frequencies, then you get as much sound coming forward as you do from going upwards. And because the upward-firing is weakened with distance by the time you hear the reflected version of it, it would always be weaker. So it would not work. However, Dolby have specified a directivity index for that top found speaker that the only thing Dolby qualify is the characteristics of that upward found speaker. They don't tell you what you have to do with the regular front firing part of the speaker. That's up to us to define in our normal way about how we would design a speaker. Mm-hmm. They only specify the top speaker in terms of frequency range, minimum sensitivity level, directivity index, maximum output level, so they can be sure with the maximum specified ceiling height that you can still get enough sound level bouncing back down to give you the effects that you want. So mm-hmm. it's that directivity factor that they place on the speaker that makes it work. There's a few other tricks of the trade that are done to make that sound more believable, that it's coming from above you rather than hearing the spill that comes direct. I don't think I can necessarily say what those are because I don't know what Dolby's position is.
You know,
yeah,
that's
we all right. sign NDAs for developing these things. So
Right.
I'm guessing
right,
that's
so there's some
Dolby
secret sauce in there. Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a look at the speakers that you have designed for this purpose, the Dolby, the Pioneer Dolby Atmos enabled speakers. Let's start with the floor standers, and there's a picture of them. And as you can see, you've got some drivers in the front, as per normal, and that one driver at the top, which is the upward firing speaker, which has a completely separate input on the back of the cabinet from the front firing drivers.
It has its own crossover network directly wired to a set of terminals towards the top of the speaker, and then all the rest of the front drivers have their own crossover networks wired to terminals at the bottom of the cabinet.
Now, one of the cool things about these speakers, all of the Dolby Atmos speakers that you have introduced now, is a new custom-designed coincident or concentric driver unit. Tell us about that.
Yes. As you know, through all the work I've done with TAD, also the first speaker I developed when I joined Pioneer, and then all the work I did when I was at KEF, I've always been a big fan of concentric drivers. And it seemed to me one of the things that concentric drivers do when I... The impression I get when I listen to a good concentric driver is the imaging capabilities that they give, locking in each sound source in the sound field. And I thought that would be particularly beneficial in a home theater setup when we're talking about sound from all the way around us. But then also in terms of what it could do for Atmos. The spec for Atmos leaves the technology up to you as long as you meet the directivity function. And I know their early demo speakers just use a single 4-inch full-range driver. It can technically meet the spec, frequency range, and output level. But I looked at it and thought, it's a bit limited in what I can do in shaping the response of it. I think I'd like to put the same concentric driver that I use on the front of the speaker on the top, because that way I get identical phase responses from the two. And just like in a stereo speaker, if you have, you need match speakers left and right. You wouldn't put, say, a concentric driver for the left speaker and a conventional speaker on the right. You wouldn't get any stereo imaging. So I'm thinking, you know, the demos I heard did have different phase characteristics between the top and the front drivers. But what would happen if I made them the same? And the only practical way to meet the directivity objectives and make them the same was to use a concentric driver approach. So I thought, yay, this gives me a chance to go back and do what I've been itching to do and develop a new concentric driver. So that's what I've done.
Fantastic. And I have a small picture of it to show if we can pull up the concentric driver image, but you might be able to show us a little bit more. There's a picture of it. must have broken your heart to take one of your drivers and have somebody saw out a high slice out of it.
Yeah, but I marvel at how they managed to do it, especially considering it's an aluminum cone and, you know, cutting through all the neodymium magnets. Of course, yeah. They weren't charged magnets at the, time.
Yeah, at that time.
You'd have a lot of iron filings around. and I have one here to give you a sense of scale of it, although, of course, it doesn't when I hold it right in front of my face. So let's move it backwards. Right. There you go.
So you can see that it's, about half the size of your face.
Yeah, so it's a 4-inch driver. It's a soft ohm tweeter with an aluminum. I can't even say it because I'm trying to say it the American way. Aluminium cone driver.
Yeah, go ahead, say it British. That's fine.
And I've put a lot of work into developing the cone profile and the multiple roll surround on this, driven by a neodymium magnet for both the tweeter and the mid-range section, and the first breakup mode on this 4-inch driver is at 8K from aluminum. There, I said it right. So it gives remarkable performance. And soft ohm tweeter, because of the price point, I felt that rather than trying to develop a lower cost but good metal dome tweeter for this, I'd stay with a soft dome with a characteristic that I knew well. And I think it's worked very well. So that
I was going to ask why your preference for soft dome tweeters as opposed to hard dome tweeters?
It's just a preference to certain price points. Obviously, with TAD and with the EX speakers, I was able to use either pure beryllium or ceramic graphite. But as you come down in price points, the metal domes are more difficult to get right because you're restricted to maybe magnesium if you're lucky, or titanium or aluminum. And titanium gives no benefits in terms of first breakup mode. It's also heavier. Magnesium gives very little benefit also in terms of first breakup mode. So you're left with playing with dome shapes and termination to control that first breakup mode. And I felt with everything that I had to develop for this speaker, I play safe in one respect and go with a very good soft dome and save experimentation for metal domes till later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so these concentric drivers have good directional characteristics that let you fire upward and also work just as well as a front-firing element. What are the other lower... Oh, before I get to that... somebody in the chat room, I just saw it and I can't find it right at the moment. Are these top firing drivers considered full range? What is their frequency extension?
The frequency extension requirement is down to about 180 hertz. That's a practical limit given the size of the speaker that you'll typically be able to put on top. And it's also a balance. If it's a single full range driver, if it's too big, you won't get the high frequency extension. Mm-hmm. If it's too small, you won't get the low frequency extension. So it's and also sensitivity levels and efficiency and power handling, they all come into play. So it's a practical specification for a realistic drive unit. So I met that specification with the concentric driver, and mm-hmm. when in the setup procedure for Dolby Atmos, typically, if it's an Atmos-enabled speaker, that speaker will be set to small. If it's a ceiling speaker, yep. It's able to be set large or certainly a lower crossover point. But for the enabled version, it's going to be typically somewhere between, let's say, 150 and 200 hertz.
Right.
Any information below that will be channeled into the front part of the speaker.
Right. So there is a crossover between the upward firing speaker and the front firing elements.
Yes, there's both crossover circuitry within the speaker and also within the receiver. It will and then it will redirect the frequencies so they don't get lost. Yep. And you know, below 200 hertz, you don't have any real ability to discriminate height. And so it doesn't sort of matter which speaker it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the other drivers then in the front, because at least in the floor standers. Well, let me put it this way. In the budget-oriented FS-52s, I believe the low-frequency extension is down to 40 hertz, which is remarkable for such inexpensive speakers. These must do at least that.
They do. It's not too much different in terms of simple bass extension. But you've got to realize that there's more to getting bass than just bass extension. There's output capability as well. And we're all governed by the laws of physics. Me in particular, since I'm a physicist. That's what those are, rather than pretending they don't exist. So given a certain size of cabinet and a certain efficiency level, you're going to get a certain low-frequency extension. And this isn't a huge speaker. You know, it's a fairly slim enclosure, not dissimilar to the size of the FS-52. So you would not expect the low-frequency extension to be much better. But what I did is I sacrificed some efficiency. I don't go for huge efficiency from the speakers because I want a performance level with extension. And what's different is these 5-inch, there's 3 5-inch bass drivers. They're much better power handling, more linear excursion capability than in the FS-52. They have a larger diameter voice coil. They're all driven equally, whereas there was some splitting of the signals in the FS-52. So they have more power capability in the bass than the FS-52, as they should, given the price point difference.
Yep, right. now, somebody...
aluminum cone bass drivers.
Okay, very good. M5 in the chat room is saying, is the inside cabinet of the top upfiring speaker sealed against the rest of the volume of the speaker? And I believe, if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, each of these drivers is in its own sealed structure.
That's correct? Right. So each CST has its own enclosure, its own sealed back enclosure. The top firing driver has actually slightly more volume behind it than the front firing one because it has to get down to 180 hertz. For the front-firing CST, does not have to go as low. I cross over at 260 hertz. So I use a slightly smaller enclosure. And then the 3 bass drivers share commonly the rest of the enclosure.
Got it. Let's take a look at the bookshelves then, which are very similar, but obviously just smaller. So tell us a little bit about these.
So it's exactly the same. It's smaller. It's a single bass driver. But still with good bass extension power handling, and particularly on music. And I have to say, I always start by designing for music and then seeing whether it will cope with movies. Because if it doesn't sound good for music and voice, it's not going to sound good for movies anyway, in my view. And I want this speaker... In some ways, you could say you could buy it as a stereo speaker and you get a bonus of a top-firing Atmos-enabled capability. Right. I want the value to be that at the price point that they are, you think, this is a really good price point for a great-sounding pair of loudspeakers. And sort of for free, I get the Atmos-enabled capability. I know in the chat rooms, everybody's going on about, oh, I don't want to have built-in something I'm not going to use. I understand that. And, you know, give me a chance. This is the first time we've done, or anyone's done, Atmos-enabled speakers. Some manufacturers have chosen just to do an add-on top speaker, but it depends on the customer, the retailers, as to what they are going to accept in the stores, what SKUs they're going to accept. In the home, at least this looks visually integrated, whereas an add-on wart on top of the speaker, your wife may not allow it in the home. So, you know, this is our first version. I'm sure we'll be doing more.
Well, you mentioned these little add-ons, and I've seen those as well. One of the concerns that immediately occurred to me was how well this sound quality, the tonal signature, if you will, would integrate with the front speakers. Here, obviously, it'll integrate very well because they're all designed as one unit. But if you just, if you have some pair of speakers and you buy a little upfiring module from somebody else and stick it on top of your speakers, I can't imagine that the sound would be all that integrated.
Well, that was the point. I was thinking, since this is a new technology, I should try and make it sound the best that it can. That doesn't mean to say in the future I won't do add-on units. You know, obviously, one of the questions that keeps getting asked is, could we do an add-on to a BS-22? And in principle, yes, we could. It's not going to perform as well because it won't integrate as well for the very reasons I said. I use the CST for top and front. But it will still work, and that depends on time. I'm just finishing off these speakers. And when I say just finishing off, I mean really just finishing off.
Yeah. Like, give me a chance, guys. Come on. I just built you a new set of speakers. What the hell do you want?
Exactly. Yeah. So I understand everyone's concerns. Got to start somewhere. And this is where we chose to start first.
The other thing, one of the other things I like about these is, as in the BS-22 and the FS-52, the cabinets are curved. I assume you use the same sort of technology that you developed for those less expensive speakers here to make strong curved cabinets that have the acoustic characteristics you were looking for.
Yes, we do. And it's exactly the same construction technique. One advantage of splitting it now into a three-way system, you know, the CST kind of forces me to go to a three-way system. That means the cabinet is not excited in the same way. In a two-way system with the bass mid driver operating all the way up to 3K, it's that bass mid driver that is exciting the cabinet. In this system, it's an entirely separate drive unit, lighter weight drive unit, its own enclosure. It doesn't excite the cabinet in quite the same way. So ultimately, you get slightly less effect from the cabinet by splitting it like this. So there is a further benefit to having done this.
Let's take a quick look at the center and sub of the new system, which I also took a picture of at CE Week. Clearly, the center does not have an up-firing Atmos driver, and because of this particular one's design, the curved cabinetry, that would be impractical. But I wonder if there's any reason to think about putting an Atmos up-firing driver into the center channel speaker to give you five height speakers, if you will, or overhead speakers.
It's not a requirement in the Dolby system. So that's why we haven't incorporated it. And so we could go back to just the visual design of using the curved cabinet on the top. So that's why it's done that way. So it's basically a conventional loudspeaker.
With, again, the CST. Remind me what CST stands for.
Coherent source transducer.
Ah, right. It's the concentric four-inch full range, well, mid-range, I guess, and soft dome tweeter. In this case, with two, five-inch, four-inch drivers on either side?
It's actually one active 5-inch bass driver and one passive radiator.
Ah. So why is it that you do an active driver and a passive radiator on either side of the CST in the center channel speaker?
Well, if you remember, you asked me the question about how close to the rear wall can we put the tower speaker? And the tower speaker has three rear firing vents. And it comes with a foam plug for one of them. So you can change the bass tuning somewhat to match the room characteristics or your taste. Now, that's fine for that. And you, like I said, you could get within about 4 inches of the wall. But with a center channel, so very often the center channel will be put into a console, not just stood on top, because your TV's maybe on top of the console. And there's often a space underneath that where you slot your center channel into. When you do that, the base energy from a rear firing vent becomes a real problem because it's venting into an interior volume and then trying to squeeze out around whatever space is left around the center channel speaker.
Yep.
So I thought instead I'll make it a passive radiator on the front. I don't like to do typically, certainly if it's a non-CST speaker, using two base mid drivers and center tweeter doesn't work very well. We do our best to make it work in lower cost product, but sideways arrangement of drive units is never so good, except when you've got a concentric driver. So with the concentric driver, because I'm crossing over so low, I don't have the lobing problems. And so I thought in this instance, by putting a passive radiator on the front, I get the base coming out directly from the front, and I won't have the issues of a rear firing vent.
Great. And just give us a quick hit on the subwoofer as well, because that's new also.
Yes, the subwoofer, it's a 10-inch long throw driver in a small box. And so for this product, I've decided to make a closed box. Because when you try and get a lot of bass out of a small enclosure, if you try and fit a vent in there, the problem is a small diameter vent makes chuffing noises, especially for large excursions, low frequencies. Now, in order to reduce the airflow, to reduce the chuffing noise, you have to increase the diameter of the vent. But the acoustics, those nasty laws of physics again, say that as you increase the diameter of the vent, to maintain the tuning frequency, it has to get longer. And often it ends up longer than the box, particularly if the box is small. So you put a bend in it. That bend now reintroduces problems with chuffing noises. And so I thought, let's go to a closed box. The downside of a closed box traditionally is it's considered to be less efficient and less output capability. But the true efficiency is governed. It's not so different. One of the problems is when you've got a closed box, you're trying to drive energy in. At the low frequency cutoff, you're trying to drive energy in when the impedance is very, very high because it's resonant frequency. And the amplifier doesn't have enough voltage swing to be able to do that, so it can't drive enough current into the high impedance. What happens when you vent a system, it splits that impedance curve into two, and now at the cutoff frequency, it's low impedance. And so you can drive the energy in. That's why in a reflex system, you can, in practice, match to the amplifier better and get that output capability. Even if you EQ a closed box system to match the frequency response of a vented box, you just can't drive the current in. So what we got inside this is an amplifier that's capable of much higher voltage. So it's a nominal 300-watt amplifier. But the supply rails allow sufficiently high to allow to drive current in at that impedance peak. So there's enough voltage swing so that at the frequencies where I need to, I can always drive the drive unit to full mechanical excursion. You know, it's about an inch peak to peak. And that way, I can maximize the output capability of the driver by properly matching to the amplifier.
So it's a much more powerful amplifier than the previous sub, which was an 8-inch sub and 100 watts, as I recall.
Yes.
So what do you get low frequency extension wise here? Useful low frequency extension.
It's about 28 to 30 hertz. So that's not bad for the size of the box. And I wanted to keep the subwoofer to be a fairly compact size. It's not a huge one. And in fact, I've had some chats on the forums about this. Is one hulking great subwoofer, can a 10-inch really provide enough output capability? Well, it's swept volume that matters. So if it moves enough, a 10-inch moving 1-inch gives more output than a 12-inch moving half an inch. And so yes, it can perform as well as a lot of 12-inch drivers, but with the added flexibility that being small, you can place it in the room maybe more easily, but you could also have two if you're really concerned about maximum output level. You know, for some people, even a long throw 10-inch is never going to be enough. And I understand that, but for most people, they can't play too loud in their room. Mm-hmm. But by using two, you can now spread how they engage with the standing waves in the room and actually get a smoother response in the room than you can with just a single subwoofer. So right,
exactly that, so. Yeah.
If you need more bass, get two of them rather
than two of them.
One big one at twice the cost.
what was the phrase in Contact, the movie Contact? John Hurt as S.R. Haddon says, why build one when you can build two at twice the price? Same sort of deal. Well, yeah. Certainly, I understand that you ideally it's better to have two subs, as you say, smooths out the response in the room, gives you more output to begin with, and yeah. also smooths out that response over a wider area. So it's really yes. a better situation.
Yeah.
But then we come to cost, and I know that these speakers are quite a bit more than your entry-level speakers, which are so highly regarded, mm-hmm. But I do want to let people know what kind of money we're talking about here.
So the bookshelves are $750 a pair. The towers are $700 each. The center channel is $400 each, and the subwoofer $600 each.
Okay.
But I did that because I wanted to, like I said earlier, put some real engineering into the first venture into an Atmos system. I mean, one thing that surprised everybody, Chris Walker keeps me, or tries to keep me honest in my design work, or keeps me to a price point. And then I showed him, Chris, this is what the crossovers are. Already when I developed the BS-22s and before that the BS-21s, we talked about it's got a real crossover in there. It's not just a single inductor and a single capacitor. I've got a real six-element network, or in the tower, an eight-element network.
This I think I'm going you can show me you. These. Yeah.
We decided this is, I don't know, a gaggle of crossovers. This is all yes. crossovers inside of this loudspeaker. So we see the bass crossover. Oh, there we go.
Move it up a little bit.
There we go.
There you go.
That's just the bass crossover, huge inductors. Yeah. Then we get the CST crossover. And
looks pretty complicated to me.
This is the top driver crossover.
Mm-hmm.
So real serious crossovers. It's amazing how much weight they contribute to the speaker. Mm-hmm. They contribute cost.
Yes.
I wanted to get real performance. And so I've targeted these speakers should sound really good, like I said, on music as well as movies, and are real engineered product.
Well, I can't wait to hear them. When are they going to be available?
I will finish my design off as soon as I finish this podcast. I think I've signed off pretty much everything for production. Production is scheduled in the next 2 weeks, I think, 2 to 3 weeks. So the design work's finished. It's all going through its final testing phases. And it will be available, I think, somewhere around late August, middle of September, that kind of time frame. So late summer.
Late summer, early fall. And the AVRs, roughly the same time frame? Probably.
It's the same time and upgradable in the first instance, I believe, but don't quote me on that. Chris okay, is probably sat watching this and going, what's he telling them?
right. No. No.
Stick with speakers, Andrew.
No, so, you know, sometime late summer, early fall, we're going to start seeing these products at retail.
Yes.
Roughly probably the same time that we'll start seeing Atmos encoded Blu-rays, which is the other piece of the puzzle that we need in order to experience this whole new thing, which I think is really quite a significant improvement over 5.1, which for movies was a significant improvement over 2-channel. And I think that it's very important development, and I'm very happy to have a chance to talk with you about it.
Yes, like I say, it won me over, and it gave me an opportunity to design a whole new class of speaker for this. And they are going to be widely distributed and on demo. So judge for yourself. Go in and get a demo and see what you think yourself of Atmos is my message.
Boy, I do hope that that there are some retail outlets that have a reasonable demo space. I mean, if you go into certainly Magnolia within Best Buy probably will have somewhat of a reasonable demo space, a room with a ceiling. But if you go into some big box store, Costco or the larger Best Buy, you know, you're not going to be able to hear it at all. So that's a challenge for the retailer, isn't it?
It is, especially dependent on price point. So I think you'll find that Best Buy will not be trying to demo Atmos, but Magnolia most certainly are. They will be fitting out about 200 theater rooms across the country to specifically be properly capable of demoing an Atmos system, and we will have our complete system on demo in those stores, so you will be able to get a good listen to them.
Excellent, excellent. Because as I've always said, that any new technology, we can talk about it all day long, and it doesn't make any difference until people actually experience it. And so it was with HD TV, so it is with Ultra HD TV, with OLED, and now with Dolby Atmos. You know, you really need to hear it. And as you said, you got won over. I was won over as soon as I heard it because, you know, it was just remarkable and continues to be at the commercial cinema level. And I do recommend that people go to Dolby.com and they have a theater finder there that you can find a Dolby Atmos theater near you. If you haven't heard it before, go find one and go to a movie that has been mixed in Dolby Atmos. And you'll be able to hear what it is we're talking about. And then come the fall, find a Magnolia near you or hopefully some other stores as well and go in and experience that because it's a real important development, I think. And
yeah, and I think it's important to understand the difference between what a movie cinema Atmos system is and what a home system is. There's been taught that this is just a dumbed-down system. Well, isn't that what a 5.1 system is? It's optimized for the environment. A theater needs lots of speakers around because you've got a huge audience and a huge room. It doesn't mean that when you go to a small room, you need 64 speakers or 20 down each side or whatever it is. You need a system that's been optimized to give the experience in that particular size of room. And I think the same thing applies here. That no, it doesn't have the same number of speakers as in an Atmos movie theater, but it has, let's say, an appropriate number. And so I think go and hear it. Don't make yes, hear in the movie theater so you can see or hear what it can really do on a large screen, but then go and hear it as the home version.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll be surprised.
Excellent, excellent point. That's exactly right. The resources are different. The scale is different. And so, you know, the equipment is going to be a little different, but they're each suited to their environment. I agree with you 100% on that. And thank you for making that point. So that's it. We've come to the end of a fascinating hour here. I want to thank Andrew Jones, Director of Loudspeaker Engineering at Pioneer Electronics, for explaining to us what's what with this Dolby Atmos at home system. And I just can't wait to hear it. Thanks so much, Andrew.
All right. Thanks once again. I enjoyed being on the show.
Great. Thank you so much. And you'll be back again if I have anything to say about it. So you can find out more about the Pioneer Atmos enabled speakers and AVRs at pioneerelectronics.com. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv. You can also follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/HTG. Also on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be none other than Michael Fremmer, the irascible analogophile and audiophile, to talk about what else? Analog, vinyl, of course. Also, high-res audio. I really want to talk to him about high-resolution digital audio, which he is involved with as well. Plus, plenty of interesting anecdotes from his wild and crazy life. So I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.